You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Naturalist. This is, surprisingly enough, Matthew Raphael Johnson, and even more surprising, the 3rd of November, 2021. Some of you know I was ill with COVID for almost a month. I was shocked that it lasted for so long, and I completely lost that time. I don't remember a lot of it, and it feels like this is still the beginning of October. So I'm going to be messed up probably until Christmas. I have no idea. If I didn't look at my computer, I wouldn't have no clue what date it is today. And I've actually mentioned on the air wrong dates, and probably will continue to do so. As I always do, I support, thank you to my supporters, as always. It's a struggle. The struggle is getting worse. And as I should do most of the time, please support my Patreon page if you can. These are, about half of them are essays that I don't normally talk about. I just published one on Marilyn Monroe, for example, the sexual revolution, stuff more like E. Michael Jones would do. Some of it's more conventional for me, but got maybe 3 books of stuff or more on there. I have 2 books coming out. I initially said it was the beginning of November. That was before I, you know, saw the light at the end of the tunnel. And so now I'm thinking after the new year, which is very vague, a book on Chinese nationalism and, you know, second half of the 20th century, and then the nominalism book, which is getting more daunting by the day. There's not a paragraph that I don't have a million problems with. It is going to be the first of its kind, and definitely worth everyone's time. I don't have a publisher yet, which I probably should get on. Anyway, searching for all this, I've got, you know, looking for a topic. I always struggle for topics here. I get so many suggestions that I usually forget about. They're good ones, but I just don't remember them. What happens all the time, and it happened this time, is because I have so many essays that I wrote a long time ago and forgot about, essays that are in rough draft form that are still worthwhile. They're buried in different folders. And this is one of those. Now, this essay is on my website, which I have not been good in keeping up with. I'm not sure why. It's a very simple one, but it has a selection of essays, and I don't even have my new book on there. So, but this is, sometimes I look at essays from years ago, and either I like them, and don't, you know, who wrote this, or I dislike them. This is one of those that I dislike. It reads more like a rough draft. I've done this before, publishing things that read more like a rough draft, and I should have taken more time with it. So I'm going to, and I rewrote this, and I'm going to re-upload it again, and I have to bring this website up to date. I don't have tons of incentive, largely because Radio Albion has all my stuff, and certainly has a far greater readership than my own. My website is simply a place to find books and the different links that I'm involved with. So the topic of today is essay I discovered forgot was on the website, is on a topic that sounds very obscure. Now, for Russia specialists, it's not. In fact, it has tremendous significance. But for those outside of that, it seems to be something that almost has no relevance, something that's so distant and obscure even for people into this stuff. And that's the battle, the alleged battle, between the Josephites and the Transvulgans in medieval Russia, so-called possessors and non-possessors. Now, the reason I wrote this essay, it's one of these many topics that has been dealt with substantially in the Russian language, but almost zero in English. Things just don't penetrate between the two countries. The scholarship in Russia is either not taken seriously in the Anglo-American world, or it's simply inconvenient. You know, Alexander Dugin is a classic example. Very little of his stuff, Ilin too, very little of this stuff is translated. Doesn't keep people from talking about him, though. And so no one really knows what's going on. But this is one of these issues that gets talked about by specialists. It comes up in Orthodox circles quite often, but it really is almost entirely invented. There was no such battle. And I want to get into why that is and why the issue was invented, both in Russia, because there was a fight here, just not like that, and then why Western scholars just bought the conventional story. It was not considered a fight at the time, and certainly not in the way that Anglo-American scholars want to talk about it. So this alleged battle between, you call them possessors and non-possessors, not the best, a bit unwieldy, but that's in English, that's how it's normally described. Medieval Russia, it is a myth. Now, this is supposed to have completely split the Russian intellectual world at the time, altered politics, and changed the trajectory that Russia was on. At the time, this was anything but obscure. More specifically, the battle is between two forms of monasticism. These are how monasteries are to be organized. And there's two. The non-possessors are supposed to be those who are either hermits or have the very small skete-style system, the anchorites. And the possessors are your typical kenobia. This is what you have, the main monasteries of Mount Athos. These are large, strictly communal institutions. The problem here is, why would these two that have always coexisted, often in the same place, I mean, a big monastery will have, you know, anchorite cells around it, why would this develop and explode like this in Russia? It doesn't make any sense. The two types of monasticism, and therefore their involvement in property holding, and that connection to the monarch, are from the ancient world. They exist in every jurisdiction, they exist in every country, and they're parallel institutions. No one has ever fought an ideological battle that one was better than the other, one was more Christian than the other. And Russia is no exception. The dispute, which is overwhelming in works on medieval Russia, was invented by a man, a Judaizing noble, named Vassian Patrikiev. And I mean Judaizing, meaning he was Strugelniki, then later became, you know, which is part of the Judaizer heresy from the generation before. And he created this battle both to protect himself and to harm his enemies. So, allegedly, you have two enemies here. The two founders of these institutions are supposed to have led this dispute. The first is one of my favorites, the leader of the Transvulgan system, St. Neil Sorsky, or St. Nilus of the Suara River, who died in 1508, and St. Joseph of Valoc, who died in 1515. So the Transvolgan elders, under St. Nilus Sorski, was a group of monks following the Skeet life, a small community run by several hermit cells scattered around a large area. St. Joseph was the abbot of the largest and wealthiest monastic institution in Russia at the time. Now, there are clearly two very different approaches to the ascetic life, but they are identical in theology. They're identical in their views of the ascetic life. They're identical in the liturgy. They're identical in fasting rules and the canons. The only difference is you have fewer people versus more people. You have slightly more structure in the larger institution simply because of how it is. But in every large monastery in old Russia and contemporary Russia, you have the anchorite cells around it. Now, personally, I've always been partisan to the anchorites because of the lack of structure, the small community that will be, you know, the almost a Cistercians in the Western world. I've always had a fascination for that. Versus a much larger, the Kenobia. You know, in America, you know, Transfiguration or Jordanville is, you know, Mantonville, Canada is run that way. In Europe, in Orthodox countries, the large institution has both types of monasticism on its very property. The claim here is that these two saints fought over which system was closer to the gospel. And then allegedly, and the issue was landholding. The issue was, should monastics be permitted to own property? Now, right away, that's a loaded question. They never asked, the simple concept is it the monastic institution or monks themselves? Well, no matter what monastery you're in, monks may not own property. They don't own what's in their cells. They own nothing. That's, you know, the canonical norm from the beginning. But the institution is a different story. The president of the U.S. doesn't own the White House. The Pope doesn't own the Vatican. Those are two very different things. A monk does not own the monastery. Therefore, a monastery can be wealthy while the monks themselves are poverty-stricken, which is how it's supposed to be. That was identical in both cases here. But what started off as a claim over landholding, and by the way, this includes a monastery owning land that has villagers on it and taxing them directly, which in a decentralized system you're going to get. So what started as a debate over monastic economics, remember, these monasteries, the big ones, were very powerful. Politically, they were more powerful than the nobles. There were checks on the noble class. And it should be noted, too, that the large monasteries in Western and Eastern Europe, without exception, were partisans of monarchy. They always, like, for example, in medieval Germany, where you didn't have a strong centralized system, even with people like Otto the First and Otto the Third having the crown of the empire. The only thing that kept the monarchy together and gave it any kind of authority at all were the large monasteries. It's rare to find a large monastery that is not in favor of strong, relatively speaking, centralized royal rule. And so much of the ideology of monarchy comes from the monastics. And Russia was probably an extreme version of that, coming straight from Byzantium. So what began as an economic, what allegedly began as an economic question, soon became one that had political ramifications, social ramifications. And at the time, we'll get into that in a minute, but the Anglo-American literature just went bonkers with this. So what started off as a question of landholding ended up being this alleged battle in terms of the Christian life, prayer,
your view of the world, metaphysics, everything else. And that was the case, not even at the time, but it got worse and worse, you know, especially in the 20th century in among American academics, English academics too. And it's taken for granted. No one even questions that this is the issue. And one point I want to make here is that it shows you that these scholars in the big American universities writing on this topic don't know anything about the faith, orthodoxy, or how monasteries run. And this is supposed to be their specialty. That's like claiming to be a specialist in Tibet and not knowing the first thing about Buddhism. Usually the line in a major American history textbook says that these two factions, you know, one was a liberal, you know, the hermits, which is laughable, that didn't want a strong monarchy, didn't believe in property holding, and that heretics shouldn't be executed. Now, this is a completely separate issue here, but that's how it's usually framed. Again, those two forms of monastic life and approaches to land holding have existed side by side as long as the church has been in existence. Now, what I'm saying is that there was no public confrontation between St. Nil and St. Joseph, nor could there be. Both men publicly praised the other, which somehow no one noticed. The very fact that St. Nil Sorsky, came out of a huge institution that was a dependency of the monastery of St. Cyril, Cyril of White Lake, which is very large and owned quite a bit of land. He never condemned them. He was on their land. So the whole thing is laughable. And it doesn't take much to find this out. So reading textbooks by Anglo-American authors on these questions, they don't even know the basics. And of course, since power is all they know, everything is structured mentally as a matter of political power. The assumption being people who have any kind of prominence in society want power above all else. That power is not a burden, power is not a problem. Therefore, if you're in power, you want more of it, which is a wild assumption that has a lot more to do with them than the subjects that they're talking about. So, after the revolution, the way that historians talked about St. Nil Sorsky, who was one of the greatest saints in Russian history, they called him somehow a communist. And these are quotes. He was the founder of a new religious movement and, worse, the forebearer of Russian liberalism. But this is how historical myths get started. One ideological story is taken for granted. Then that becomes exaggerated and it affects everything else, which creates an entire historical argument that has no basis in fact. This is an extreme example. But this happens all over the place. But this is typical of Western liberal historiography. The assumption is that history is one big machine that exists to generate liberalism and the end of history. We call it Whig history over here. That everybody is essentially an Englishman, a free trading liberal Englishmen, they just need to get rid of their oppressive culture, and then they will become just like us. That is still functional in how the foreign policy of the regime works. And everyone just wants to be Anglo-American liberal free traders. All you have to do is overthrow these states, and they'll see. They'll treat us as liberators. And this has been the myth governing not just international relations, but economics for a very long time. Because the regime claims that the Transvaalian elders were liberals, quote-unquote, they want to parlay that into a claim that had they been, had that movement
the way that it's perceived, become victorious, you would have a liberal Russia, you would have a Russian Reformation, and it would be just like Western European history. You know, one of the biggest tells that you're dealing with an amateur, you're not dealing with a very good historian, is that they use contemporary language, contemporary ideologies, and they read it back, you know, centuries, if not millennia before, as if liberalism could make any possible sense at the beginning of 16th century Russia. It doesn't even make any sense. There was no concept of that absurdity there. There wasn't even, they didn't have the language to express it, even if there was. It's like, I can't remember, I think it was Alan Bloom, who does a lot of good stuff or did a lot of good things, using phrases like civil rights in his translation of Plato's Republic. I mean, they're using that phrase, it's ridiculous. There was no context for that at the time. It didn't exist, the notion, for better or for worse, didn't exist at the time. And it gets even worse. You understand why this is important here. In the English language literature, it's even asserted that St. Nil supported heresy. They even say that they, I'll get a couple quotes for you here in a minute, that he sought a separation of church and state. In fact, this assumption is so common that it's never challenged. They try to spin the distinction between the two forms of monasticism, since which they don't understand, into a more familiar battle between liberalism and conservatism, which, you know, again, is couldn't be any less appropriate. And it shows the mockery of itself that Anglo-American history is, has long since become. And these people are getting six-figure salaries for specializing in Russian history, medieval or modern. And that they don't even understand this. And I'm not sure how they're expected to, given the lives they lead and the ideology that they are forced to support. That's the significance of this issue here. So it starts off what seems to be an obscure issue between two very specific forms of monasticism, totally unknown except among Orthodox or Catholic people. And even them, you know, aren't necessarily familiar with it. Becomes of immense significance when it's taken to refer to the possibility of a reformation in Russia. And this is why liberalism was strangled by the monarchy of Basil III, etc. And I actually got two surveys of history, Russian history, by people who, you know, aren't awful, which is the highest compliment I can give. A.G. Mazur, who wrote Russia, Czarist, and Communist in 1962, and someone I do cite from time to time, Jeffrey Hoskins, an Englishman who wrote Russia and the Russians, a history, as Harvard University Press came out in 2001. Now, Mazur in 62, he spends not tons of time, but it's a survey of all of Russian history. And he calls this rivalry a sharp conflict. And he says that St. Nil was, quote, an early champion of the separation of church and state. This is supposed to, you know, the concept there didn't exist. You couldn't even use that language. And then it gets worse. He says that St. Joseph used, quote, Calvinist logic to argue that wealth was itself a grace of God for which each member should be grateful and praise the Almighty, end quote. That's on page 44. Then he says that St. Joseph insisted on a strict execution of church services. And then that St. Nil rejected the great adorned houses of worship, insisting the heart was more important than the temple. On page 45. But even those who created this myth never said anything like that. This man literally made it up. No one, not even at the time, you know, Vassian Patrikiev, the guy who really created this whole thing, he never used those words. No one used those words until the 20th century. Insisting the heart was more important than the temple. Calvinist logic. Mazur quite literally made it up. He heard this somewhere and he wrote it. Johnson's Law, no one's probably going to notice. No one's really in any position to challenge me. Now, Jeffrey Hoskins, and he wrote, of course, they're all bad books. You know, it's in the sense that they force liberalism on every page. His book in 2001 did say, believe it or not, that the distinction may not have been as important as it was once thought. But then he ruins that by saying that the rivalry between the two groups existed over other issues. So what he's trying to do, okay, maybe the land ownership thing didn't matter, but they can't get over the myth that liberalism would, you know, it would be just like Britain if the possessors didn't win. If the possessors lost, you would have, you know, a free trading, liberal, anti-royal Russian state. That's what this is all about. Well, there's a reason they didn't become all liberals. Well, that's because of the monks. And they do this with a lot of topics. This is just the stupidest. So Hoskins even says that St. Joseph was advocating a, quote, quasi-papal view of church-state relations. While St. Nil said the church should avoid too close of an association with the state. He says that on page 104, 105. I mean, he has access to whatever he wants at Harvard. I mean, he could, you know, it took me 15 minutes, or well, maybe more than that, 20 minutes, to realize that this is entirely invented. These statements are completely made up. Even those who invented this thing didn't say that. So now you have two very well-known, standard texts in Russian history, one from the early 60s, the other from more recently, with completely made-up stories. I mean, Mazur has an impressive career. I mean, typical American academic, he does what he's told, but still, he was very influential at Stanford. But how irresponsible and absurd to completely make this stuff up. And it's an admission that the man knows not the first thing about monasticism or medieval Russia, which is supposed to be his specialty. Again, what they do is they take what's unfamiliar, then they'll recast it in a way that moderns will understand. It becomes an ideological morality play between the liberal good guys and the right-wing bad guys. But in order to get there, they have to make things up. The story that these guys write, they have no relation whatsoever to either the events or the ideologies of the time. So if they do that here, where else are they doing it? My first book, which, you know, was cringy in parts because I was very angry when I wrote it, and it can be funny in parts. It's really a blueprint for what I was going to do for the rest of my life, and I've stuck to it, pokes fun at these. In fact, the entire book is pointing out where this kind of thing is done. And these are people who have access to everything they need, they have an army of assistants, and I suppose this is what happens, because some of these guys depend on grad student papers to get their work done. But this is the nature of historiography, in the West. And because Russia, for most Americans, is very obscure, the history is almost entirely unknown, they can get away with making things up, or exaggerating things or playing things down. But the fact that these guys can't even make the distinction between institutional wealth and the individual monastic is strange. I mean, Hoskins, and there's a few others more recently that try to go in that direction, but even that's very rare. That's a very simple distinction. These are the people who will make the claim, the Catholic Church is the wealthiest institution in the world. As if bishops own the cathedrals. You know, the Pope can't, you know, buy and sell dioceses and pocket the profits. And that's a very simple distinction. So the literature knows no bounds to its enthusiasm. And you see how this is applied in some cases to the Bolsheviks, certainly how it's applied to the Masonic Revolution, of Kerensky, and of course now the attacks on Vladimir Putin. I mean, it just goes on and on. Neil Sorsky's movement, they're called Russian Protestants, liberal reformers, and in one case, anarchist progressives. And it gets even more inflammatory. That's how they describe an extremely strict ascetic, strictly Orthodox in every respect, closely connected to a huge institution, St. Nosorsky. Again, it's like being a specialist in Indian history and knowing nothing about Hinduism. This is another example of Johnson's Law, although a historical application rather than a political one. In medieval Russia, this became very important. Monasteries were the central, even more than the crown, the central institution in local life. This is why Peter the Great smashed them. Peter the Great did just what the Bolsheviks did, except he had far fewer resources at his disposal. Before the Bolsheviks, believe it or not, the Russian Empire did not have a lot of bureaucrats. The Russian Empire could not enforce a lot of laws locally for this reason. They relied on noble families, they relied on communes, etc., and they could nullify, just as a matter of practicality, any law they wanted. So the myths, they start off, the czars were authoritarian and absolute. And then that gets taken to extremes. They torture people for no reason. They kill babies. And that gets taken for granted. And so what do they say after that? All based on nothing. Neil Sorsky and Joseph Vlach are two extremely significant figures in Russian theology and monasticism. And Orthodox people, of course, they're quoted constantly. But when you don't know anything about the monastic life or asceticism and how central it is to Russian history, well, you're going to make stupid statements like this. St. Joseph's best-known work is a compendia called The Illuminator. It's allegedly the place where a lot of his errors, so-called, are to be found. What these guys don't know is that at least a portion of the Illuminator was written by St. Neil. Nikolai Lysov has made a very convincing argument here. We'll get to it in a second. Now, the rules and basic customs of all Orthodox monasteries are identical on the issue of personal property. If there is personal property, eventually it's going to get the monk into trouble. There are no exceptions to this. Every monastic rule ever written in the Orthodox world completely rejects the owning of any personal property by the individual monk, no matter what office he may have. Now, as an institution, it has to possess property. It has to own its own building and the land around it, or the monastery wouldn't exist. But maybe that's exactly the issue here. And this can be applied to anything. The property is not owned by monks as people, but as a corporate body, essentially, owned by the Metropolitan, and technically, the monarchy itself. I mean, how would St. Neil even have a title to his land if he didn't own property? It was under the technical ownership of a huge canobia that he allegedly condemned. And of course, he did no such thing. But how could he even have a title to his land? And no one even bothers to ask this. Evie Romanenko writes this in 1986. Nilus of Swara and Joseph of Luck chose different forms of monastic life. Elder Nilus the Skeet, while the abbot of Lachmanus chose a Cenobian. In accordance with this, they have chosen different systems of property ownership, and there was no contradiction between them, as both systems date back to the early history of Orthodox monasticism, which is reflected in the lives of ancient saints. Okay, now, you have people like St. Basil the Great who did have some distrust of the anchorite. You see some of this, even St. Benedict. But of course, they tolerated it because they knew that it had a role. But this issue, St. Joseph had nothing but praise for St. Neil. His own house, his own monastery, had anchorites, or hermits, on the grounds. Usually what happens is the monk gets older. He gets very advanced in the ascetic life to the point where he is a venerated elder. He doesn't seem to need anything. He wants to then, at some point, avoid the politics of, especially if it's a large monastery, and give himself entirely to contemplation. And this is why some of these guys, with permission of the abbot and sometimes the bishop, choose to leave that institution and go right in the same property, though, to a little cell a bit farther away. The word monasticism comes from the Greek word to mean to be alone. So the skeet life, the skeet, hermitage, anchorite, these are almost synonymous. Those types are for advanced monks who wanted greater silence in their lives, and they needed permission to do it. St. Neil's successor, Cornelius of Comel, was also a saint. Actually, tried to, and this has happened many times before, incorporated different elements of both rules in his own house, his own institution, proving that there was no fight between the two. The Order of St. Romuald, who is Orthodox Western order coming from St. Benedict, incorporates both types. I think I said last week in my book on nominalism, I have an entire section on St. Benedict and Romuald and their rejection of nominalism in very specific ways. No one's certainly done that before. But there are metaphysical foundations to these types and these mentalities, but the theology is exactly the same. Now, I mentioned capital punishment. Somehow, Vasily and Patrikhiv and those who were trying to, create this battle made the claim that St. Joseph wanted heretics executed. They don't say which ones or why, and that St. Neil was opposed to this. That's not true either. There's no distinction between any monastic foundation in its views of capital punishment. There's a very specific reason why Vasily and Patrikhiv said this. And really, in terms of capital punishment in general, monks of all types tended to disagree. Russia generally didn't have the death penalty for a lot of its history. Now, Elder Hermann, who was one of St. Neil's teachers, actually held that heretics, under certain circumstances, should be executed. Nikolai Lisov, who argued that, in fact, St. Neil wrote a good chunk of the Illuminator, he said, quote, in other words, Vasily and Patrikhiv and the so-called non-possessor ideology is nothing more than the spiritual and intellectual provocation from a beleaguered elite, end quote. And he also says this. I mentioned that St. Neil wrote part of the Illuminator, and certainly true. And he says this about it. They had, talking about St. Joseph and St. Neil, they had the finest relationship. St. Joseph of Luck sent to the St. Neil skeet for his disciples. And at the hand of St. Neil, and this is a staggering truth, can be found the oldest edition of the Illuminator of St. Joseph. Some researchers are even ready to attribute the Illuminator to St. Neil rather than St. Joseph. at least the shorter original version. But one thing is clear, that contrary to popular notions, both monks were so close to each other in their doctrine of monastic life that St. Neil took Joseph's Illuminator as his own book, copied and distributed it to others. And he continues, as his work was Lissov wrote in 2008, he continues in another place, and this is about landholding in particular. Monastic peasants were under the spiritual care of the respective monastery that cared about their spiritual and physical sustenance, and saw to it that drinking, gambling, etc., that which ruins the peasant economy, was eradicated. Unlike the noble estates, there was no arbitrariness under the monastics, no violence against women, which did flourish in the estates of the nobility until the abolition of serfdom in 1861. There were no landlord harems. Peasants are not sold, were not lost at cards, and not exchanged. Now, Lissov, I think, is wrong in general about how peasants were treated. There were communes, not individual peasants, and the landlords didn't have really the power to do much about it. But in most Orthodox countries, if a village is owned by a monastery, they were in very good shape. I know in the Serbian law code of Emperor Dusan, and I do have a book on medieval Serbia where I talk about this at some length, monastic peasants are not drafted into the army. Their taxes are lower. And then Lissov cites a letter from Lermontov, the famous writer, in 1841, where the historian says that monastic serfs were never sold for the interests of abbot or bishops. Now, let's keep in mind that serfs were not bought and sold. The whole concept of serfdom was to prevent large landlords from stealing labor from the smaller ones, especially after the time of troubles, and offering them, you know, better conditions. This is why, not to mention the fact, that it guaranteed serf land. The land and the serf were connected legally, which certainly suited them just fine. To be landless is certainly voluntary during this era. Peasants were organized in communes, sometimes a very large number that had their own, I've talked about this at length elsewhere, had their own traditions that were very politically astute, contrary to the mythology. And landlords, except possibly the most powerful, could do very little about what they wanted to do, and they could, as I've said elsewhere, nullify laws. They had their own courts and everything else. So it's not like an individual peasant goes up against a landlord. It's ridiculous. It's true that in the 18th century, and there's very good reasons for this, that especially foreigners abused the position of landowner by selling serfs like slaves. That was illegal. It was never done on a regular basis. And those who did it usually were connected to someone very powerful. Under Lord Byron's German and Masonic occupation of the country, that did happen. But it wasn't legal. So serfs and monks were legally, almost canonically identical. And they worked beside them. These guys don't even know that monks had to work the land. They had no choice. That was part of the mission. They worked side by side. And keep in mind, too, that monasticism is really not, I mean, for as far as the intensity of the asceticism, outside of that, households are supposed to be monasteries. To be organized in that same kind of a way, with the patriarch as the abbot. And don't forget what a household was. Up until the 20th century, households referred to the extended family. That's why there is a political significance to it, and an economic significance, where the average, you know, household had possibly 20 to 50 people in a group of houses in an area. That's what the extended family is. The way we live today, of course, is completely unnatural. So there really was no distinction between monks and serfs, except the rule itself. And really, monasticism is the center of church life. You can't be a bishop unless you come from there, despite 20th century deviations. bishops usually are abbots of the great monastery, or at least have a lot of monastic experience. This is the model and archetype for the Orthodox household. There's been no Christian society that didn't have monastic property, you know, the large institutions as well as the skeet system. From England to Siberia, this has always been the case. Now, I want to talk about Vasi and Patriki. The battle that allegedly defined medieval Russian history was created by this man. At the end of his life, he was not a member of the Orthodox Church. But just like the Judaizers a bit before, and the Strigelniki, which this man was a part of, and the Judaizers are pretty much the same. They always used, like you know, the Lutherans used indulgences as an excuse to begin attacking the church as an institution. And landholding here was the thin end of the wedge. It was a means to attack the church as such. And Patrikiv did this exact same thing. It's been spun to refer to a battle between the two forms of monasticism, rather than a polemical attack from a non-Orthodox, who was a disgraced nobleman like Valsian, who, because he sided with the wrong faction, sided with Dmitri in the succession battles at the time, was sent to exile and forced to become a monk. He never wanted to be one. That's where the name Vasian came from. But I've read St. Nilsorsky, everything available, and there isn't a shred of evidence anywhere that he believed that all monastic houses should sell off their lands. What that would mean, and this is why Patriki was so important, is that the monastery wouldn't exist, and the local nobility would absorb it. The fact that Vasian Patrikiv was from an extremely powerful Russo-Lithuanian family is very significant here. The large monasteries were a check on the nobility, a very powerful one in the entire Christian world, actually, as well as a huge supporter of Christian monarchy. But the myth makers will go even farther than that. They'll say that there was a synod in 1503 in Moscow to deal with the issue. They claim that Nilsorsky was there and fought St. Joseph. St. Nilsorsky was not there, but Vasian Patrikiv, given his wealth and power, claimed that he was sent by him. He did not. He didn't have this authority, was not sent by him. And the synod wasn't called in reference to landholding anyway. The two issues were widowed clergy, remarriage, and very technical issues over simony. So the legend of the non-possessors came from Patrikiv and the old boyar class. In fact, the phrase non-possessor was used for the first time at his trial in 1531. Now, in the Illuminator itself, this is supposed to be the Bible of St. Joseph in his non-Christian greed, sections 4 and 5 of the shorter Illuminator, you see a strict policy of non-possession laid out for all of St. Joseph's monks and all monks. And that proves, of course, that there was no battle and that these writers, then and now, have never read this stuff. St. Nil was one of the most popular and copied authors and was disseminated heavily at St. Joseph's Monastery. Dositheus, Dionysius, Ephim of the Abbot, all elites at St. Joseph's Monastery were promoters of St. Nil and his works while they were there. There was no battle. There was no fight between these two. But Patrikiv had an issue. Like I say, he was descended from a noble Lithuanian family. His father, Ivan, was a cousin of Grand Duke Ivan III. In the 1490s, Prince Vasily Patrikiv was extremely influential Wesley was his name before he became, was forcibly to become a monk. He was very high in the elite. He took part in the war with Lithuania. He was a voivode during the Russian-Swedish War, 95-97, and participated in the highest state court. But I mentioned, too, that he fought on the wrong side. His family supported Dmitry Ivanovich over Basil. And so in 1499, they fell into disgrace, and they were tonsured as monks. This is how that occurred. And Patrikiev ended up in the monastery of White Lake. That's where he met Nosorsky. But despite the influence of St. Nell, Vassian was no ascetic. So Vassian returned to Moscow, and he did amend his relationship with Basil III. And that's where the first battle between St. Joseph and Vassian took place. In fact, St. Joseph then is worried, because no one trusted Vassian, and he asked the Grand Duke to conduct a search of those connected to Vassian's group. That's when Vassian wrote his work condemning St. Joseph and monastic property holding. In other words, Vassian Patrikiev was under investigation before ever developing this non-possessory ideology. And Basil sided with Vassian for a while. And that's where this battle began. He created it. And St. Joseph, aware of the problems with the Judaizing heresy, which I've dealt with elsewhere, and the Strigelniki, was extremely upset about Vassian's ideology. It had very little to do with property holding. Soon, Vassian, before he openly became a Judaizer, began to oppose the priesthood, the sacraments, icons, the typical, you know, Bogomil ideology. It's all one and the same Kabbalistic movement. And St. Joseph was worried about this before the landholding issue was ever developed. St. Nell had nothing to do with any of this. Although J.S. Lurie does say that the chronicler of the White Lake Monastery, they did have a certain pride in their wealth and origin. And the non-possessors were mostly clerks and some low-level nobles. But they attempted to promote the view as Transvolgan elders. You had low-level and sometimes elite nobles angry at those like St. Joseph for their support of the monarchy, and they began writing in their name. Patrikiev wrote as if he were St. Nell, and he created this debate as a means not only of weakening the monastery, the monarchy, but defending himself. The response of the elders of Cyril White Lake Monastery, that was the core faction. The response was allegedly from these non-possessor monks. They were not the views of St. Nell. This was a group of nobles that wrote this. And it wasn't until the 19th century where the liberal westernizers created the liberal St. Nell for their own purposes. And one of these is Mykola Kostomarov, the famous Ukrainian historian, who I've actually cited elsewhere. And he said that St. Joseph, and this is a direct quote, he said, wrote a very strict charter to his monastery in order to avoid accusations that monastics were involved in business and banking, rule that all the control and punishment of monastic subjects did not take place in the monastery itself. And he quotes Vassian. He says, despising the fear of God and his own salvation, St. Joseph permits mercilessly tormenting and torturing those in debt to the monastery somewhere behind the walls before the gates. To execute peasants in the monastery is not a sin. Allegedly, Vassian said that, which is probably true. But none of it is real. Kostomarov's work, and Kostomarov is not bad on other issues, but nothing remotely links these two things in this respect. First of all, Joseph did not write a rule, a charter. Like all monasteries, he was under the rule of St. Sergius itself from the KFKs and ultimately the Studion. Secondly, nothing in the rule or of any of St. Joseph's writings permit these gross abuses. It was crude propaganda. But he makes up one story, and then he stretches it to make up another. Then he says, well, St. Neil rejected the execution of heretics. St. Joseph wanted to do it. Well, they don't mean any old heretic. They mean Judaizer. We're talking about a group of very wealthy people deliberately infiltrating the church and the monastic life for the sole purpose of destroying it. And if the monasteries were a central institution of public power, this was a direct attack on the state. But by the time he invented the whole Nils against execution nonsense, Patrick Keefe was already a part of the Judaizer Strigelnicki sect. So the heresy issue, the execution issue, was to protect himself. He thinks, he knows he's in a certain amount of trouble. He's been in trouble before. So he then invents the idea that St. Neil was opposed to executing people like, I mean, heretics. He even writes under Neil's name, saying that the relics of the major monasteries are false, and that heretics are martyrs. This is one of the reasons it took a long time for St. Neil to be canonized. So, the 1503 synod that I mentioned, Vassian claiming to be a representative of St. Neil, he gave the impression that the purpose of the Skete rule was a rejection of luxury, as if the Spartan rule of the Studion accepted it. And then he actually made the claim that St. Neil demanded the secularization of all monastic properties, which was a cardinal point of all the Judaizer groups. Never uttered by St. Neil. This is why the monarchy eventually turned on him. So Kostomarov continues this mythology. He says, faithful to the basic views of his mentor, St. Neil, Vassian wanted the original view of monastic piety that places no value in church singing, readings, church services, drapari, and all the rest, but in the study of the divine prophets, evangelists, apostles, and the works of the Holy Father that are constant with the teachings of Christ. Constant with the teachings of Christ. Notice how he words this. No value in reading, services, or drapari, but only to study prophets and evangelists and the works of the Holy Fathers consonant with the teaching of Christ. He doesn't mention any names. That is very much deliberate. Of course, the truth is that the Skete tradition used all the ritual of the Orthodox Church without fail and without omission, just on a smaller scale. So Vassian, who was already converted to heresy, had been for some time, placed these words in the mouth of St. Neil so as to render the church a Puritan Protestant movement and to protect himself. There is no reason to believe that St. Neil, I know there's every reason to believe St. Neil would reject this stuff vehemently. Kostomarov then attributes the writings of Patrick Keefe to St. Neil. And that, again, St. Neil wrote his own charter. You can't write your own rules. But in Neil's works, nothing of Patrick Keefe's ideas can be found. The hermits under St. Neil were dependencies of the White Lake Monastery under the Studite rule anyway. St. Neil performed the all-night vigil according to the strict typikon several times a week. Icons and relics, no different than any other monastery. The outward rule of the Studion was taken for granted. In fact, hermits are usually stricter than the communal monks. The so-called response, which again Patrick Keefe had a hand in writing, had nothing to do with monasticism anyway. It was an apology for individualism, idiorhythm. And Lisov is one of these scholars who reminds us that the rule of the Skete is not separate from anything else. St. Neil was on Athos. In the main monastery, as well among the Skete dwellers, property was completely forbidden. So that distinction could never have been made by St. Neil. It didn't exist. Then Kostomarov says, since that time, Joseph became an avowed and implacable enemy of Neil. Which, of course, is absurd. No alterations of the Charter of St. Sergius could ever be made. Because that would then, any challenge to that would be to challenge St. Sergius and Mount Athos. No one would have understood this distinction. Now, as far as any usury is concerned, that was unfortunately from the same nobility that sided with
Patrick Heath. You did have money lent at interest, which was controlled by the state. And there's no reason to hold that Neil differed from Joseph in any respect. There was no... The lending at interest was simply a noble pastime. The church had always condemned any interest whatsoever and loans. And so much that the countryside wasn't monetized anyway, I'm not sure who they're giving these loans to. So Valcian rewrote all these canons, rewrote, Bible did everything he could, and presented them to Ivan III as ancient doctrine. And of course, it's a very bad forgery. An Athenite monk was strict, rule-bound, liturgical. So condemning monastic estates would be to condemn Athos itself. This was a self-interest. The secularism of the oligarchy. Any ruler who wanted a strong church out of the way, Peter the Great being chief among them later on. Vatican eventually rejected Christ's divinity, the sacraments, the New Testament. Like Simon Boudny, he was a Judaizer. This was revealed in the Synod of 1531. And St. Maximin the Greek, who they always tried to drag into this, had nothing to do with any of these views. Vatican was condemned, but not for being a non-possessor. He was condemned as a Judaizer and someone who was at war with not just the church, but the state. Anyway, I didn't quite finish everything I wanted to talk about. Ultimately what happens, and really the purpose of all of this, is for modern historians to claim that there is this liberal tradition in Orthodoxy. Paul Valera has his the liberal tradition in Russian Orthodox theology. You have... Donald Ostrowski, 1986, continuing this mythology. Paul Valera, in his liberal tradition work, tries to use Soloviev, which he wasn't even Orthodox. And the people who he claims are liberals are those who rejected the reforms of Peter the Great, as if that's anything but a conservative point of view. Since Peter was a revolutionary. And of course, he traces it back to this controversy. James Cunningham tries to do the same thing. The modern university can't understand Orthodox monasticism. Professors are overwhelmingly urban, alienated, liberal parents. They live in fear that any stray word or gesture may be interpreted as vaguely offensive to liberals and lead to the destruction of his career. This is absolutely absurd. So to summarize all this, there was never any dispute at any level between the two saints, Joseph and Neil. They were allies both personally and ideologically. This dispute was invented between heretical sects and the state. Valcian Patrikhiv and that faction of the nobility at war with the royal house via the monastery. Monasteries will always be attacked by Judaizers everywhere since it is the absolute core of the faith. You don't see it too much in America because monasteries aren't that powerful. But later on, it was then taken up by liberal historians to invent a liberal tradition in Russia. The Orthodox Reformation would have had its source here. But the debate began in 1503 with the heretic Vatian defending himself, claiming some authority from St. Neil on his own heresy, something he invented to protect himself. It was only centuries later that it was revised and assumed to be true. St. Joseph and St. Neil were very close. All monastic rules are non-possessor. It's a make-believe issue in a make-believe story. I mentioned the inflammatory ways that historians have described St. Neil. And it's to support this point of view that all human beings are the same and culture only distorts the march to the end of history, liberal democracy and capitalism.
Well, Russia seems to be an exception to this, so they have to invent something that changes that. There's a few other examples of this invention, but one of the worst is the non-possessor movement. And they've invented this, or have gone along with the invention of this, to allow themselves to show that Russians are all liberals under the skin. You know, James Cunningham, Paul Valéry, so many others, Ostrowski, are not knowledgeable in the Orthodox life, since they either don't understand or don't care. And because of Johnson's law, they could say whatever they want. So that's the issue here. American historians are a disaster on Russian topics. They're secular, neurotic, spoiled, and alienated. They attempt to understand Russia from a Western, urban, liberal point of view without any grasp of Orthodox doctrine. Trying to write an old Russia from this neurotic, secular world of the ladder-climbing academic is ridiculous. It's the very negation of what scholarship is supposed to be. It is a parody. Thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.